This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
So we have a two-hour film programme. That's a very nice thing.
Yeah,
we also have...
After what I got for Christmas.
What do you get for Christmas?
You know, I have this thing, right? Every year, learn a new musical instrument. Okay?
Yes.
Keeps you young. Seriously, if anybody's listening, it's a really good thing. Learn a new musical instrument every year. Keeps
what
you
have
young.
We moved on to this year?
Well, last year it was bagpipes. No, 2 years ago it was bagpipes. Last year it was theremin, which I have to say it hasn't quite worked out the way I expected because the theremin turned out to be the instrument that nobody could play at all. But this year, stylophone.
Right, so this is the Rolf Harris original.
It is.
And what you've done is you've learnt a new theme. I don't know if you're going to do requests, actually.
I am going to do requests until I get requested to stop.
Okay, but cinematic only.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. There you go. It's the great sound of a stylophone.
Do a scale. Okay, and you've been... I've gone off it already.
Have you?
We've got a new two-hour show. New year, new two-hour show. We've got a new theme tune.
Okay.
Take it away.
What do you think?
Don't know, really.
Okay.
But, you can do requests, and it's 85058, mayo@bbc.co.uk. Andy Serkis is going to be our first guest. How exciting is that?
The mighty Andy Serkis.
The mighty Andy
Serkis. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And, of course, I think one of the first winners of the coveted Kermode Awards. That means he has a statuette of me somewhere. He probably got rid of it by now, which he won Best Supporting Actor for King Kong back 4 or 5 years ago, I think, now.
And some Haddock business, some Hobbit business.
Yes, some 3D business.
Some 3D business,
obviously.
Indeed.
And I've got to say about the other fantastic Christmas present which I've got in relation to 3D, but I'll bring it up when it comes to 3D. I have been given the most brilliant anti-3D Christmas present.
I think we'll be the judge of that. So we're here till 4 o'clock, longer, faster and stronger and rantier. C. Gittner via Twitter a few moments ago. Good luck with the new programme. Bet you still review the film of the week at 2 minutes to 4.
Yeah, and that was always the assumption, wasn't it? No matter how much time you give them. Actually, we could start by doing something.
I think it's expected.
Okay.
Here's an email from Alex Campbell. Alex, you're on first. Alex is in Cambridge. This is about The Last Airbender. One of the topics that we were discussing last year, Dear Egg and Chips, somebody may have already pointed this out, but in case they haven't, I thought I should do before they do. Recently, the two of you have been deriving some amusement from trying to work out the prospective plot of M. Night Shyamalan's new epic.
Can I just say it's Shyamalan? You keep saying some other word. Say Shyamalan.
It's how I've always said
it
in my
head. No, but say Shyamalan.
M. Night Shyamalan.
No, Shyamalan, that's like nuclear. You're like George Bush and nuclear power. It's Shyamalan.
He's got a new film and it's called The Last Airbender, has M. Night as friends of him.
Yeah.
Referred to him as. And without having seen the film, says Alex, or read anything about it, I believe I have the answer. If you remember, when Dr. K reviewed M. Night
Shyamalan's
Last Offering, The Happening, he posed a question to the listeners who had seen it. The question was, what's making the wind blow? I believe the pieces have now fallen into place and that this film serves as a direct answer to the good doctor's question. A sequel, if you like. Question, what's making the wind blow? Answer, it's The Last Airbender.
Very good.
Hope this helps.
I do you the theme from The Exorcist. Hang on, listen. Well, it requires practice, actually. Miss McNeil, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon, she says she's the devil himself.
Scary.
Isn't it just the best thing?
Well, no, I would say. But I mean, we are available for... I think there'll be a limit. And once we get beyond that, 3 or 4...
You've reached the limit already, haven't you?
Yeah. John saying, is the good doctor going to flap his massive windy hands for 2 hours? He'll be exhausted. Well, you should say, you can watch this. We are live streaming. The whole two-hour thing. You go to the website, live stream. That's why we've had to turn...
Can
very
I say something about the big
on.
Windy hands issue?
Yes.
It's funny how nobody ever mentioned the fact that I had big hands until somebody on In the Loop, in a fleeting... It was a
Chris
scene...
Chris Addison, yeah.
Yeah, lasted about 3 seconds. Chris Addison, who's, you know, coming... Lasted about 3 seconds, was looking at the television and said, quote, God, Kermode, you've got really big hands.
Yes.
And then since then, that's the only thing people say. Big hands. I've gone from being bequiffed Mark Kermode to big-handed Mark Kermode.
Flappy hands.
Flappy hands. Happy. If I go to church, are they happy, clappy, flappy hands?
Almost certainly.
Excellent.
Nice boy in flappy hands. David saying, welcome back. Felitz and Oscar. I see Piranha 3D is out this year, surely destined to be enough to push The Good Doctor over.
Yeah, although if you're going to do a 3D movie, it should be something like Piranha 3D. I mean, I was saying with the 3D stuff last year, My Bloody Valentine was one of the few movies that kind of justified the 3D-ness in the same way as Flesh for Frankenstein, because it sort of suits exploitation and silliness, and, you know, that's the kind of movie that it works for.
Dear Sam and Gertie, what a treat to listen to your review of the year, which we did in the new year, of course.
We
reflecting
did.
Reflecting on 2009. Yes. Mm. I usually listen on the train to work on a podcast. Sometimes get to see you live and inglorious, flappy, handy Technicolor.
Have they actually written that, or are you just making it up?
I just added the flappy, handy bit in there.
Right, thank you.
So it says, this is Samantha Clarkson in Chesham, MA in Museum Studies. I hadn't seen any of the worst 10 films of 2009, even though many of them spent time at number one in the box office chart, thus doing my little bit to stick it to the Hollywood man and the likes of McGee, as he's known. However, I had seen 7 of the best 10, including Let the Right One In, which I saw at a screening with an audience of only 3 people, but have lent to many more on DVD since. The only one I should probably never see is Antichrist, as although I'm sure it's marvellous, as The Good Doctor likes it, mutilation is not my bag.
Antichrist is out on DVD this Monday.
And it's one of the films where you don't want to see any extras, though.
No, although, funnily enough, the DVD comes with a load of extras. Here's the interesting thing about Antichrist.
But I don't want to see
Okay.
I've seen enough in the film.
Yeah, except, there's a special extra, but it's essentially, it's the talking behind the movies. Because as you remember Willem Dafoe, who appears in a new release this week, Daybreakers, Willem Dafoe came on the show, and Willem Dafoe did the whole thing about, you know, the time that Lars von Trier was making Antichrist, he was very, very depressed, and he was, you know, clinically depressed, and actually the actors had to help him through all this stuff. And on the DVD extras, it's all this stuff about Lars von Trier, you know, being very serious and being seriously depressed, and the philosophical research. I still think, despite what may be on the DVD extras, anyone who takes Lars von Trier seriously does so at their peril. He is a prankster. I don't believe any of it. I don't believe anything he says in extras or in interviews. That doesn't mean that I don't think there aren't great things in Antichrist. It was definitely one of my 10 films of last year. But you should never, never, never take Lars von Trier at his word or indeed seriously. It was when he made that comedy, the name of which I can't even remember now, which was, he said it was filmed in AutoVision. He said one of the reasons that all the shots throughout the thing was they got this new computer system called AutoVision, which, no, they hadn't. It was just a prank. It was just a gag. That's what he does. He's a prankster. He's a comedian. It's like, you know, people taking his movie seriously are doing both him and the films a disservice. But there is stuff in Antichrist that is genuinely astonishing. If you get to the moment in Antichrist when the fox talks, one of two things will happen. You'll either go, blimey, in which case you're with it, or you'll go, oh, don't be silly, in which case you're probably not with it. Did you see Antichrist?
I haven't seen it yet. No.
How about introducing our guest properly?
Oh, sorry. No, you do it, because that's your job.
Ladies and gentlemen, how lucky are we to have one of our favourite actors in the whole world in our studio for our first elongated wit attack?
I'm going to do a fanfare.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen,
it's good though, isn't it? Circus. Do you want to go? You have to touch it very, very gently.
I actually had one of these about the time
David Bowie used to play one. He played one
immediately on the promotional
track.
Look
at track. That, very...
What a tart.
He's.
that sounds like an Ian Dury song.
It does, funny enough.
How extraordinary.
Not that much like an Ian Dury song.
Andy Serkis is here. He's the star of Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. He is Ian Dury, and what a pleasure to have you in the show. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks for having me back. Happy New Year to you. How was Christmas?
Now, what hair... Christmas? Can't remember.
No.
Now, what hair are we looking at here? Because we're in classic kind of circus mode, but we've seen you in various kind of Dickensian modes and Victorian modes. And is this Haddock?
It's kind of between mode, but not kind of fully gelled down... competing with Mark Commode mode.
But you are competing with, actually, because when you came in, I thought, oh, he's done it on purpose. He's actually, because the last time I was standing next to you, there was some awards ceremony, and you had the big hair, and I thought, you do this every time. You put the quiff up just in order to go, see, bigger quiff than Commode.
No, but you've got much more control in your hair.
I know, so. But yours is still more buoyant. what do you use on this?
It's black and white. Dax
and Tweed Georgia Brown, yeah.
I'm sorry, you've lost everybody in the whole country on that one.
Well, those of us that don't have hair control problems.
John Bell says, possibly the most obvious request, but there's only one choice, please. Being from Newcastle, I'm a big fan of the film. It's my third favourite, though. Can I request Local Hero, please?
Oh, on the... Yeah, sure, hang on.
Style of phone. Massacre it for everybody who loves it.
I'll have to figure this out. Oh, come on.
But- unrecognizable.
He was better when I did it on the bagpipes, yeah. Wasn't it?
Various requests coming in. Once Upon a Time in America, the Superman theme.
No, hang on. Let me show you the best one, because this has got a thing. It's got a thing that you can tune the whole thing down.
The biggest request, by the way, overwhelmingly, is
shut
to
up.
Stop. Yes.
Right, listen. Shh. This is my favourite one.
That works.
Not it's right, not difficult, that one, is it? I mean, no.
It's not to do with difficulty, Andy. It's to do with just, you know, invention and charm. That's the whole point about the stylophone, is it says on the box, you need no musical talent at all to play it, as I think I've demonstrated. Box, isn't it lovely? Yeah. It's the original thing.
We discuss sex, drugs and rock and roll in just a few minutes' time. And Andy Serkis is here. One of the big new films of the year, Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. It's a biopic.
It's a kind of a collage, an essence, an energy of the man.
A collage, an essence. You're in Sued's corner straight away. So explain what people are going to see when they go and see this.
Well, it's not kind of Ian Dury, born 1942, cut to, you know, pram rocking and you know, so on, and finishes in 2000 with Ian dying of cancer. It's not that. It's a sort of it's a Peter Blake sort of collage, pop art. Self-seance. Ian comes onto the stage and starts to we wanted to do a film about Ian where it felt like, you know, a live Blockheads gig, that he tells his own story. And if Ian was telling his own story, how would he do it? Well, he'd be not very reverential, he'd take the piss out of himself, he'd take the mickey out of himself, he would we always had him on our shoulder and imagined, and along with his family, imagined, you know, what would he think of this? And he really wouldn't be too po-faced about himself. And that was so. It's got an emotional heart. I think it's got the father-son relationship, which kind of keeps the whole thing driving along, and is about the creative spirit of a man who is very chaotic, but at the same time is trying to keep all the emotional plates spinning, relationships, whilst having the freedom to be on this planet for a short space of time and be magnificent.
And you mentioned Peter Blake, and it's worth, I mean, he went to art school, you went to art school,
that's right.
He taught in art school, and there is a kind of an art school feel about it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, before I became an actor, I studied visual arts, and it informs my acting, and it always has done. And for instance, you know, whatever character I play, it's always in a. I mean, I've talked to you about this before. Yeah. You know, doing Gollum or Kong or any of those characters, I look at paintings of Francis Bacon or Egon Schiele or whatever, you know, and sort of Photoshop them together in my mind and put them together, and that helps me get a piece of
sure.
The character.
Was it always your intention to sing yourself? Because there are some contrasting versions of the kind of the music biopic. There's the Whacking Phoenix way of doing it.
The ones that work and the ones that don't.
Where he sings his own stuff when he's Johnny Cash, and there's the Edith Piaf route.
In which she doesn't. Although, in Marianne Cotillard's defence, and I mean, I said this at the time, I think Marianne Cotillard should have been allowed to have a go at doing Edith Piaf, because I would rather I think in order to do these things properly, there has to be a continuity of voice, from spoken voice to singing voice. And it's not a question of whether or not, you know, when they did La Vie en Rose, they said, oh, well, nobody can sing like Edith Piaf. Yes, but it's the film. The film makes, you know, you have to have the same voice doing the talking and doing the singing. I mean, this goes back to Gary Busey doing all his own vocals in the Buddy Holly story, and, of course, then recording an album of Buddy Holly, which I think went on to win a Grammy Award. Val Kilmer, who I'm not a huge fan of generally, but who
I
did do a very, very good impression of Jim Morrison in That's The Doors, great. No One Here Gets Out Awake. And then, you know, most recently, Control. And, of course, I think you would agree with this, that it has to be the same voice that does the talking that does the singing.
Absolutely. I mean, and the thing is, Ian never thought of himself as a great singer, a great vocalist, and so I was, that was good for me. it was about acting through the songs, and in a sort of Brechtian way, and a way of getting kind of charged lyricism across in a very challenging way, and you know, kind of a uniqueness. And so I wasn't ever really, I watched a lot of stuff, as you do if you're playing a character like Ian, of course, for the physicality and so on, but when it came to doing the stuff on stage, I was very keen to do my take on his stuff, and that was the only way it was going to appear fresh to an audience. You can't get into impersonation. It was never our intention to do.
Is there much film stuff of Kilburn and the High Roads? Because I only ever heard them, I never saw them.
There's very, very little. There's literally
This is Ian's first band.
Yes, yeah. Prior to the Blockheads, he toured with Kilburn and the High Roads, and Yeah, no, there's literally, I've only ever seen two or three pieces of footage.
Because there's some photographs of them in which they look incredibly cool, wearing like drape coats and big brothel. I mean, they look like real, genuine, full-on teddy boy, you know, hard nuts.
Well, they're all like, the thing is about Kilburn and the High-Rise is they all look totally, totally individual. And they look like care in the community. I mean, they look like, kind of, you know, you know, coats and hats and whiskey long emigre beards and, you know, Ian with his limp and, you know, they just didn't look like they should be together. It's not like, it isn't like now this kind of homogenous, you know, boy bandy type look. And it's, that's what's so wonderful about that era is that it is the era of doing itself. And it's kind of...
Was there one thing that you had in your mind, if I can only crack that, then I've got the essence of Ian Joy? Is that far too simplistic an approach? Was there one thing you thought... That's what I have to get. That more than anything else is the essence of Ian Dury.
I think, the thing that I really had to crack was, you know, he was incredibly, articulate and full on and used lots of personas. And, you know, one of the things in the film that we had to be very careful of is that it didn't turn you off as a watcher, just watching someone at full tilt all the time and on, you know, performing. And so getting the emotional scenes, getting the scenes where you saw another side of him was very, very important. And that actually was really helped by talking to his family who became very close to us and helped us. And the fabric of what they gave us is absolutely up there on the screen. All the stories that came from Jemima, his daughter, and Baxter, his son, of course, that's what the main relationship is, and Sophie, his widow. You know, they when they first watched the screening, we sat down, me, Paul Virag, the writer, and Matt Wycross, the director, and after talking about it for 2 years and them coming and watching bits of us filming, and they were like, you know, we really respect you for actually putting our take up on there, and they really felt that we'd honoured them, and that was the biggest, that was the most nerve-wracking part of it, actually, because you've got such a responsibility with someone like Ian. I've played other real people, but someone who you're sitting in front of family members who have very personal, you know, takes on their father and husband, and you know, you really do feel that weight of that responsibility. So I think, I suppose, in answer to your question, yeah, the thing of cracking it was seeing a side of Ian that perhaps you might not necessarily see in the public persona.
Without further ado, I feel people are going to say, well, you know, give us an example of what it sounds like. You know, we can hear Ian Dury in our heads, we can hear Andy Serkis, now we want to put the two together. So let's play an example of this. So we'll do the singing stuff first of all.
Okay.
So this
is a bit of talking before the singing. Just
is there?
There is a little bit of talking in this clip just before the singing, unless they've recut it since we last heard it.
Why don't then you introduce it? Therefore, if it sounds inappropriate, then you are the one that looks.
Here's dark. A clip that may involve some talking before the singing.
That might get all.
Got it.
Every bit of clothing ought to make you pretty. You can cut the clothing, play such a pity. I should wear the clothing of Mr. Walter Mitty. See my tailor, he's got a little bit of advice, you're quite welcome, it is free. Don't do nothing that is cut price, you know what it'll make you think. Don't look tight and tricky, do my tracking with the ordinary. Get your teeth into a small slice, the cake of liberty!
I think everyone now, they're going to relax, because they know you've got it. Because they're thinking, yep, that sounds like a live Ian Dury gig.
It was amazing recording with the Blockheads, because prior to the shoot we had in last February, I found myself in a room this size with Norman Watroy and Chaz Jankel and the rest of the gang, Mickey Gallagher and Johnny Turnbull, and it was like I thought, I've wished for this. This is what I've wanted to do, and now my wish has come true, and now I've got to stand up to the plate and sing. And the first song was Wake Up and Make Love to Me, and with me, sorry. And I was thinking, this could go either way at this point. They could all leave the room and it would all be over. And so it was really nerve-wracking. And then so we did 18 songs in 2 days. And
wow. Must have been strange for them.
I think it was. And actually, David Payne, the sax player, the brilliant David Payne, said, "Oh no, it's like a bloody séance, you know." It was really cool. You know, they were so supportive. And once I sort of got through my nerves at the beginning of it, they were really, and they came down and they watched us perform at Watford Palace when we recorded for 4 days there, when we filmed all the stage stuff. And Chaz Jankel and I have become really quite close friends. He lives up the road from me, and he's a jazzer, and I play tenor sax. And in fact, on the
do you play
score,
tenor sax?
I do. And on the score, I play some of the jazz interludes between the scenes. I recorded with Chaz and his
would you band. Be and based on that experience? Would you think we could do a few gigs?
Tour.
You know, could you
well,
do
we've
a
talked
tour?
About it. We talked about it. I mean,
Blockheads with Andy Serkis.
I did sing with them last week at the Electric Ballroom. I went down and did the encore. I did Reasons to Be Cheerful and Blockheads with them at the Electric Ballroom, which was amazingly good fun.
Kevin Spacey toured with the after he'd done Beyond the Sea. He toured as Bobby Vinton. I mean, Bobby
Darren.
Vinton.
Darren.
Bobby Darren. Bobby Vinton's blue. Yes, I mean, and he did. And apparently, he was very, very good. You should do that. You should. And I didn't know you played saxophone as well.
Do you do
is
the
there no end to your talent?
Do you do the song that you did about Noddy, which we can't actually talk about at all?
It's not in the film, but I do know that song. I do love
funny.
That song. But I do. There is that lovely Harold Hill of Harold Hill song, which you probably can say on the radio. Actually.
Can you do the Lord's Prayer?
The busman's prayer.
Yeah, the one. Our Father art in Hendon, hallowed be thy
name. Which ends in
thy kingdom come, yeah, thy will be
done.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And forgive us our Westminsters as we forgive those who Westminsters against us, which is a strangely prophetic line.
There is a
for thine is the Kingston.
That's it.
The
you're just doing it but out of sequence.
Forever and ever, crouch end.
Crouch end.
Which we're forgetting.
N8. It is quite clear from the film that not only was he not a saint, he actually wasn't very nice sometimes. And I think you met him once.
I did meet him. I was working with brilliant director Max Stafford Clarke, who I worked with at the Royal Court, and he was doing an adaptation of Sue Townsend's book, The Queen and I, which is about the Queen being rehoused on a council estate in Leicester. So we all went up to Leicester for a week to workshop this piece, and Ian came up with Mickey Gallagher from the Blockheads. And my first meeting with him was in a Chinese restaurant in Leicester, where he was out of it and really quite obnoxious and quite vile and really nasty, and you know, it all kicked off, and he was quite abusive to the waiters, and you know, it wasn't a very pleasant experience. And then Mickey Gallagher, it was the night that Mickey Gallagher dumped him on the pavement outside the hotel and said, right, that's it, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm not, you know, because he was his carer more or less by then. And it was and I thought, and I'm really glad that I had that experience, because you know, I've loved Ian and his music for, you know, since I was 14, and it was actually great to see, and you know, in retrospect, it was great to see. Yeah, you can make something. You can make, you know, you can. I didn't want to make this, or none of us who made this film wanted to make it a kind of an idolising session about what a marvellous poet, you know, he was a complicated, difficult human being who, for good or ill, we've tried to put up there, and it is warts and all, and people might find him unsympathetic, but I think where the saving grace about him as a character is that it was done, whatever he did, it was just full throttle, it was full blooded, and it, you know, it was done from a position of honesty. So I think I think that's, if a character has that, it sort of is a saving grace.
Andy Serkis is here. Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, one of the big new movies of the week.
Welcome back, music. I just figured this out. Listen.
Welcome back, music. That's a treat.
Oh, come on.
Okay. As a final,
that was fantastic.
Thank you, Andy. Can I just say, incidentally, on the subject of Andy's performance in Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, which I saw last year and I really, really liked, and I did a blog thing about how it was great, because what he'd managed to do is to pitch it between, it's not imitation, it's between, you know, reinvention and taking, and I said he's only doing Ian Dury, in as much as, for example, Dury was doing Gene Vincent. It's a way of taking, you know, taking the parameters of a character and turning it into something else. And I think what was really funny is that when the BAFTA Awards thing started up, they, you know, and this because it was quite early on that I saw it and I really liked it. I said, oh, Andy Serkis' performance is this brilliantly pitched between these two things. And they sent out the BAFTA stuff, and that was the quote. By the time it gets to there, everyone else has said nice things about you. Now I don't even count. Now all the posters say, everyone else in the world, Andy Serkis is the best actor in the whole world, news of the world. What happened to me? So fine, I was first, but apparently irrelevant. But thanks,
listen,
for
you're
that.
The closest to my heart.
Thank you, Andy. No, I'm sure you that. Say that to all of
no,
them.
No,
and those
not.
big flappy hands clunking the table there.
I'm sorry.
Bashing
I'm
the
sorry,
table.
I can't not clunk the table.
Neil Sullivan said, just clicked onto the live feed for the first time. See what everyone means about the hands. They're so big. Great to have you guys back. Love the show, Steve.
Love the show, Steve.
essential. To put in there. Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road's been turned into a film. John Hillcoat's going to be joining us in about 5-10 minutes. The interesting thing about both these films, Andy, they are extremely different, clearly, but actually they're both father-son movies,
yes,
in a way, and the relationship between Ian and Baxter is crucial to your film, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that was, you know, as I was saying earlier, we wanted... You know, it's an investigation of creative spirit or creative, you know, whatever you do that you fulfill your life with, managing that and family. And also the writer, Paul Virag, and I both have got severe issues with our absentee fathers and our sons of immigrants we are. And so we wanted to kind of investigate that. And then when we started talking to Baxter, it sort of chimed in. We kind of all kind of poured our hearts on the table and sort of said, well... You know, if we all had kind of idyllic versions of our dads, and how they lived up and how they lived up to it in reality was very different, and that's something that we wanted to, you know, because actually what happens in our film is Ian's father's left him at quite a young age, and then he does, you know, obviously he kind of sins of the father, and he does the same thing, but meanwhile he's got this sort of creative maelstrom going on around him, so he's constantly feeling guilty about it, but at the same time can't stop himself. And it's about trying to not take out too many people on the way, whilst trying to live your life to the full, I suppose.
Yes. John Hillcote's joined us.
Hello, John.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Have you met before, you two?
No.
Andy Serkis. John Hillcote. I was just saying, clearly your films are very different, but
yeah,
that father-son relationship, which is so crucial to your film, is kind of crucial to Andy's film as well.
Sure. I'm at a slight disadvantage here.
You haven't
here
seen it yet? Have you not been sent a DVD? Everyone's got them.
Were you an Ian Dury fan?
I did, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was in Australia at the time, and he was... the rhythm stick song was just playing every day, everywhere.
It is staggering what an enormous hit that was, isn't it? Because I saw Ian Dury and the Blockheads play on the Live Stiffs tour, right, and he played drums for Reckless Eric.
Did he
played drums, and Denise Rudette played bass.
That's right.
And at that point, they were fantastically ramshackle, and Elvis Costello was on that same bill. But the idea that he would somehow become this global superstar was just absolutely unimaginable.
And he was so refreshing. I mean, I'll just never forget how he came across. You know, he was so unusual, and his energy and his vibe was so, immediately he had this kind of presence.
Because he was new wave in a way, although he's far kind of theatrical and pantomime as well, but it came as part of all that new wave era, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a very extraordinary kind of mixture of old style music hall. I mean, Max Wall was a big hero of his. Max Miller was a big hero of his. You know, jazz. You know, Ornette Coleman, John Coltrane, really massively sort of informed him. And then, you know, he was. You know, absolutely at that time when coming out of the pub rock scene when punk was kicking off. So it's a very heady, weird kind of mixture. Because he did do a performance at the Apollo Hammersmith when Max Wall came on stage, actually, before he did. He introduced, I think he was standing off stage and he went, and now the jewel in England's glory, will you welcome on stage? And on came Max Wall. And all the punks started booing Max Wall. And he came bombing on stage and told them what a bunch of...
Thank you.
They were. And then he kicked into, you know, Wake Up and Wake
Well, there was an, there was an instance, that I may be misremembering this, correct me, but there was an instance in his life in which he was accused at one point of kicking a policeman, and it was argued that he couldn't possibly have done it. Although, actually, having seen the film, he, you know, he seems to be pretty tasty.
He'd have worked out a way if he wanted to.
No, you know, there, I mean, there's, yeah, no, he could, hand, I mean, he could handle himself, but he more often than not would start a fight and then back off and let other people do it for him. And, and so, and it's very interesting also the whole kind of the his disability and the way that he related to his disability, because on the one hand he was someone who in the early days kind of tried to pretend it wasn't there, even though he had a great big stonking caliper on his leg and he had to haul his body around, but and as and progressively over the years and going to moving towards spasticus autisticus, which was his kind of chant against his rant against the United Year of Disabled, he began to disrobe, and so you'd be seeing kind of flesh and his withered left arm and so on. But I mean, he played the disability card when he wanted to, or he refused to, or you know, he'd sort of stand back and go, I, you know, you can't hit me, I'm a cripple. You know, it was like he really
he'd use it when he suited. And just a word on that, because the training that you did for that side of this work in portraying the disability, I mean, you do need to explain quite the lengths that you went to, Andy, on this.
Well, yeah, I wanted to get to a point where I didn't have to think about any of that stuff, because playing disability in a film, it's, you know, you're taking on a major sort of responsibility, really. And the thing is, he never considered himself disabled because he wasn't born with that disability. It was thrust on him. You know, polio he contracted when he was 8 years old, and so he didn't have the, you know, he never felt self-pitying in that way. Not that disabled people are self-pitying, but he never thought of himself as a victim, rather. He always mentally, that was the contradiction, actually, is that there's this kind of mental force going forward, and then his body was kind of pinning him down. And so I worked for months on wearing a caliper and building up the right hand side of my body, and then not using my left hand side of my body, and lost a couple of stone and so on. And this isn't a sort of like just method actor sort of waffle to sort of have something to say. I felt it really, really important to try and get as far as I could with that, so that it wasn't, so that I didn't have to think about it on the day.
Because there's a sequence where we see you getting dressed in the morning, and I'd assumed that I was looking at prosthetics or something that had been added, or some special effect. But actually, I now think what I'm looking at is your kind of useless leg with your beefed up leg.
Well, it's a little bit. There is a bit of smoke and mirrors, I have to say, because I mean, but the point is that I did do. You know, I was working out on the right hand side of my body, but I mean, I'll spoil it for people. But you know, it was just to get his. He had a very, very iconic kind of gait that people who would know, like all the Blockheads fans would know, you know, would know that.
Yeah. And which was oddly aggressive and threatening. That was almost the best thing about it. It wasn't he would walk in a way that looked like he was coming onto me. I saw him coming on stage like a dangerous character.
That's right. And Sophie Dury kind of said to me, she gave me a whole list of notes about, you know, getting in and out of cars and how he uses people as a prop to get from thing to thing, and you know, and how he would walk with his mind, or hand on his shoulder, and then as she said, and it was a great note. She just said he's got the energy of a Tyrannosaurus Rex with a maimed left arm and leg, and that's pretty spot on, actually.
That's what I meant by just the unusual personality that came across, the impact. I never even thought about the disability side until much, much later.
Yeah.
It was I didn't even get that.
Well, Johnny Lydon, you know, basically copied Ian Dury. You know, in the Sex Pistols, the way that he stood over, leering over the mic, actually Ian went down one day and with his minder at the time, and they stood either side of Malcolm McLaren and said, "What? He's wearing a razor blade earring, which is what I've got on, and he's standing over the mic like I stand, and yet, you know, what's going on?
Now, I need sort of some business here, and I don't know how long you can stay with us, 'cause I know John has to go at 3.
Right.
I know we should have done all this off air, but you know, here we are. So.
But we don't.
but we didn't. It's just there's lots that, you know, we want to talk about Haddock and want to talk about Hobbit and all that kind of stuff. Can you hang around?
I think I better check.
Check? Because otherwise I'll have to say goodbye.
Go and check with your people.
Come back.
Start talking to John.
Yeah, we'll do that.
How's Vigo? Is he all right?
And Andy, bear in mind, if you don't come back, I will take it personally.
Okay.
Just to be sure. Okay.
If you don't come back, the Hobbit will flop. You know, everything rides on what Mark says.
Guillermo likes to, you know, ask me about things, and you know, so
So come back.
I'll be right back.
Anyway, next we're going to talk to John Hillcoat. Going to talk about the road. If you've read the book, you may well have many questions for this. This is a Cormac McCarthy book, of course, and we're very pleased that John Hillcoat's going to be here. Because this must be
going to be here. I am here.
Yeah. Yes. What did I say?
Going to be here.
Well, you are going
to
be here.
He's overwhelmed, John, that he's forgotten how to use the English language. Yeah.
But you are going to be here for a while.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Until that's 3. Okay. So I think that's all clear.
Yeah.
Mud.
Paddy says, this is Paddy Dummett. Hi, no qualifications and no pactual, but I did have a love affair with Nina in the back of my quarter. As a genuine Ian Dury fan, the death of Ian is the only one of a public figure that ever genuinely affected me. Great to hear the clip of Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll. Andy sounds great. And presumably...
Expect to see him in nominations, incidentally.
You reckon?
Oh, well, I would be shocked if not.
John Hillcoat in with news of when he has to go.
We're just finding out. I think I can hang around till 10 past.
That's great, fine. That's great.
Fine, well, let's wrap up with Andy now, in a kind of a polite way, which he doesn't feel disrespected in any way. But the opinion of the fans, the real hardcore fans who still love Ian Dury, really does matter, doesn't it? Because you have to turn in a performance where, like, you know, but I think most people will be convinced when you say, you know, if it's good enough for the Blockheads, it's going to be good enough for most people. But it is important that people go, yeah, absolutely. That's it. I love him.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true, and it was great the other night. As I say, down at the Electric Ballroom, they were quite. Well, they came down to Watford Palace actually when we were filming for the 4 days of doing all the live gig stuff, and they were just really into it. And it was interesting because I stayed in character for the 4 days. So every time I went on stage in between takes and so on, I kept the MC sort of stuff going. And then when I went down to the Electric Ballroom the other day, and I wasn't in character really, and it was sort of a bit odd. I wouldn't have limped on stage particularly, just to, you know, it would have been slow, that a bit weird really. So that was a different version.
So just finally, just tell us about Haddock and tell us about Hobbit and what we can expect from you. I mean, I know we're going over the next couple of years essentially.
Well, actually, I'll tell you what I'm doing, which is quite interesting.
Is that a bit of Hobbit voice you just did?
No, it wasn't actually.
Almost.
God, I've just realised I've not read The Traffic as Gollum. I must be moving on.
When you've done it a couple of times, you know, you're going to have to get back into that. Will it take its toll on the voice box?
There's a very strange moment in the new St Trinians movie in which Toby Jones, who plays Dobby in the Harry Potter movies, reaches out for a ring and goes, "My precious." And I'm going, "Hang on, no, that's wrong." It's very odd.
You just done a Gollum impression in front of Gollum.
Yeah, I know, but he's seen it before. He's forgiven me in the past.
So how does that pan out, Andy?
Well, so about kind of roughly halfway through this year, then I'll be probably tootling off down to New Zealand to work with Guillermo and Peter. I know that they're writing the scripts. I don't really know too much more about it.
But how exciting to go back into that trilogy, really, this time knowing how absolutely huge it was.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's great. And I know that, I mean, I think Guillermo's take will be extraordinary, and it'll be lovely to have you know, with Peter and Middle Earth being what it is and it feeling like what it is, but with a pair of fresh eyes will be extraordinary.
Are you a fan, John, of Guillermo del Toro and Peter Jackson?
Yeah, I mean, I loved actually Peter Jackson, Heavenly Creatures. I thought was just fantastic. Beautiful. I was blown away.
It is extraordinary.
I love what I liked about Lord of the Rings and that whole trilogy is that. For those types of films, it felt like everyone involved was really committed and there was a sincerity to it. There wasn't this kind of just marketing merchandise aspect. And that was really refreshing, I found, for, you know, that type of material of that scale.
And then Captain Haddock and Tintin?
Yeah, well, we shot Tintin last year. In the middle, early to middle of last year, and great. I mean, it's great fun. I can't really talk too much about it now because it's coming out in 2011. But lovely working with Jamie Bell and Daniel Craig and Simon Pegg, Nick Frost. You know, wonderful.
What voice did you do for Haddock?
Oh, I can't tell. That's top secret.
Did he have an accent?
He did actually. Yeah.
Where's he from?
I'll tell you.
He's not Belgian, is he?
Yeah.
Is it Crouchend?
Yeah.
Andy's fantastic to see you. And you're welcome anytime, Andy Serkis. Thanks very much indeed for coming down. That's Andy Serkis. So, John Hillcoat is here. The Road is out. What an astonishing book. What an astonishing film. John, when was the first time you picked up the book? Tell us about that reaction that you had, this kind of visceral reaction to the book the first time you read it.
That was 2006. I read it before it was published, and yeah, it just completely floored me. I was a big Cormac fan before that, but I wasn't expecting the emotional pull of the father and son relationship. In fact, when I heard it was a post-apocalyptic tale, I kind of was a little bit like, oh, don't know about this, Cormac. I was just so engrossed. And yeah.
Why did you have that reaction about post-apocalyptic tale?
All the cliches, all the baggage that's out there actually came flooding into my own head, and it wasn't only until I started. It was kind of put to one side on that first page of the book. I don't know what it is. I guess I'm just I think it's kind of one of those genres that in recent years, certain films have been and made such an impact on that genre that there's been so many spin-offs that those cliches kind of magnify, I guess, in your own imagination.
Well, it is worth saying that despite the fact that The Road conforms to none of those, and we should say, I'm sure everybody knows this, but Cormac McCarthy, obviously the novelist who wrote No Country for Old Men, Blood Meridian, all the Pretty Horses, that although it conforms to none of those, the original trailers that were put together, the teaser trailers were put together for The Road, basically were attempting to make it look like an apocalypse movie, because everyone thinks, oh, it's an apocalypse movie, let's have stuff, you know, dying and falling.
Did it say the feel-good movie of the decade?
That's right. You enjoyed Mamma Mia, now laugh along. No, but there was a sense in that early thing, wasn't there, that they didn't know how to deal with a post-apocalyptic movie that was not
so different. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, that I had absolutely no control over any of that, but it was a bit of a shock, and especially for the people that had read the book. You know, it was like, what the hell is this? And as a filmmaker, what the hell is all this footage that you've never shot and never considered using?
Because there's a moment where, I know this sounds really stupid, but you do find yourself thinking, wow, a post-apocalyptic world's not a lot of fun. Because often in post-apocalyptic films, you're going to think, well, this is all right, this is quite fun, everyone's going to survive, and there'll be a nice... It's all right. This... You kind of know, because it's stated very clearly, the world is dying.
Shall we? We do have a clip of Viggo Mortensen. Should we play that? Because I think this kind of sets the world up that you're talking about quite well.
Appropriately timed.
And thank you very much.
The clock stopped at 1:17. There was a long sheer of bright light, then a series of low concussions. I think it's October, but I can't be sure. I haven't kept a calendar for years. Each day is more gray than the one before. It is cold and growing colder as the world slowly dies. No animals have survived, and all the crops are long gone. Soon all the trees in the world will fall.
I can imagine people thinking, you know, this is going to be great. I'm going to go and see a film about a world that's colder than the one I live in anyway.
But that is the overwhelming turn of it, isn't it? Every day the sky is greyer and it's getting cold. And this is also very early in the beginning of the film. It's not getting any better. It's actually getting worse. And so consequently, you are faced with that dilemma of how you then make dramatically engaging a story which sets out at the very beginning. You know, it's that old Kurt Vonnegut thing about a story that begins at a point of no hope and goes downhill from there. But the hope, of course, is encapsulated by the relationship between the father and son.
Yeah. And just explain a bit about the father and son. Viggo Mortensen, people will be familiar with, of course, and also that Mark has been going on for years about how he's the new Robert De Niro.
He is. I'm sorry, he really is the new Robert De Niro. But is one of the greatest screen actors around.
You also introduce us to Cody Schmidt-McPhee, an astonishing boy. Mm. Just explain a little bit about those two and how important this relationship was for you, John.
I mean, because it's such a painfully intimate a love story between a father and son, and what the child has to go through, though, is quite extraordinary. So I didn't even consider, I mean, I was looking in America, I was trying to find a child that had, you know, this unbelievable sort of range of emotion, and it worried me and troubled me more than anything to do with the, you know, I knew I'd be under fire taking on a book that is so beloved. I mean, that's always going to be the case.
From America's greatest living author.
Yeah, I mean, all that stuff. I knew, you know, every rifle would be aimed at me. But my overwhelming fear was the kid, you know. And I was thinking of how do you protect a kid as well to, you know, like as an actor, like how do you... because there's some pretty confronting scenes of you know how people behave under pressure, you know Cody was just and also I find with a lot of child actors in films sometimes there's this whole kind of showbiz vibe that you get from some of them. And so I was just extremely lucky. He came actually from Australia. I didn't even think to look there because...
shame on you.
You know, I know it is. And I learned my lesson. I just thought the accent would be just one more additional burden that would be too much. Ironically, we ended up not even having to have a dialogue coach at any point.
Because the kid had watched so much TV, he could do it perfectly.
I'm afraid that's...
Oh, no, I said that as a joke. Is that
okay. No, in America, I mean, we call it Little America now. Australia is just, you know, so kids... And the geographical isolation. And I think that's why Australians actually can handle the American accent so effectively.
And did Viggo have a say in that? Yeah. Or did you just put them together and see what happened?
Yeah, we had a short list I wanted to do is just see how they, you know, obviously that relationship was the key. So I wanted to get a short list, and he volunteered to make himself available for working with these kids to pin it down. So we had we ended up having four fantastic kids, and then we brought in Cody. I saved Cody for the last because I did sense
thought he was the best.
Yeah.
The man in the suit and the tie is Mark Kermode. The man in the green top is John Hillcoat. The Road is his movie. Just some emails here.
I like the suit.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, he wears it every week without exception. Martin in Old Portsmouth. Dear Bala Bala and Valari. Topical reference, he who spots it wins a prize, says Martin.
Bala Bala Bala, Valari.
I don't Valari.
Bala Bala Bala.
Anyway, he says, The Road, we have a problem. It would seem that critical opinion is united in this being a very fine film. Capital V, capital F, capital F. Mm-hmm. Which is just as well, because what with Viggo Mortensen being in it, we'll get no sense out of Dr. K, who loses all his critical faculties when the zygomatically gifted Viking descendant commits anything to celluloid. I want Viggo to appear in a Michael Bay movie. This would obviously set up a quantum paradox causing Mark to destroy himself, but would he explode or implode? Anyway, on a serious note, it would seem that there was no CGI used in The Road. Please thank John Hillcoat for me. May others choose to follow his lead. The curse of overt CGI needs to be exercised. As Dr. K wisely points out, if it looks like CGI, the illusion is broken. What's the truth on this?
Well, certainly I agree about the illusion is broken, and that's what my beef with CGI, I think, it's particularly if they create things that have no basis in reality, there's still this the gravity, there's no proper gravity.
There's no
the
weight.
So things move in... You know, I even had that problem with... I was especially surprised with Avatar, the blue people, how they looked like 1970s Panel Van Art to me. But I love the illusion of cinema, you know, that I love being lost in films. And I, you know, when a film's not working, that's when I start to look at those sort of aspects. And I hate being taken out of that world. You know, I like being an audience member. Yes, we did use CGI. It was always the last resort, but we had a great guy, Mark Forker, who came out of... He worked on the Lord of the Rings and various films like that. But he was a photographer, and that's a critical thing. He came out of photography, and he understood the need to hide what you do.
Because you said that you went to, or you shot from locations that, you know, that,
yeah.
And so explain how you did that. Well, how did those fit into the film?
By the way, with CGI, it was things like in these incredible locations in the middle of Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania countryside in winter, you still on ash piles or wherever you are. You'll still get jet streams, or birds, or some, you know.
And there are no birds, and no planes, and no wildlife.
Had to, or distant traffic, or whatever. There was just endless.
It's like
signs
a period
of life.
Drama problem. I mean, it's a futuristic film, but it's like a period drama issue, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, absolutely. So we didn't want anyone to be brought out of that reality that we were trying to create. So we really actually just looked at places where, New Orleans, where they're still cleaning up Katrina after all these years, Mount St. Helens. I mean, we wanted, speaking earlier about cliche, we wanted to avoid the post-apocalypse worlds tend to really draw heavily on urban iconography. And the book is a road journey across America, and so much of America is... between New York and L.A. And so we really wanted to go for suburbs and countrysides, and particularly countryside like Mount St. Helens. That's where half a mountain blew up. Mm. So we did our own post-apocalypse now tour of just actual zones in America that happened to be in the place that nicely coincided with tax breaks.
I had a fairly unique experience watching the film because I had to leave 25 minutes before the end.
Oh.
I had to do that because it was a screening.
I told you that. I almost physically did that response that John Hillcoat just did.
I have to physically leave right now. Sorry.
I saw the whole film twice straight through, so you can stay.
There was a screening that I had to leave to come and do the programme. The reason was it was entirely professional. I was just thinking, I can't stay. No. So therefore, my experience is an incomplete experience, so I have to go and see it again. But here's an email from listener Alex, who I think will probably sum up what a lot of people think when they come out of the film. Okay,
great.
He says, "Saw The Road earlier today, and it was quite possibly one of the most depressing films I've ever seen. The obvious post-apocalyptic themes, coupled with the unrelentingly bleak, almost black and white cinematography, made for a very uncomfortable and unrelenting cinema experience. At the same time, the film was also one of the most touching and heartwarming I've seen in the past few months. Such a strong father-son relationship, rarely seen on screen in this age of sappy rom-coms. It's complicated, step forward. And ultimately, this bond gave the film a poignant and very moving undercurrent, despite the otherwise hopeless nature of their journey. Highly recommended," says Alex.
Oh, well, thank God for that second part.
Well, I was going to say, that's why I put it. But people will react in that way, in as much as it is relentless and it is depressing. Yeah. Hey, it's the end of the world. What else is it going to be?
Yeah, how else could you represent the apocalypse? It is our worst fear. So why, try and turn it into, as we were talking about earlier, something exciting and enticing? And we all know, I think, just how... the depths that we can all sink, as humans, when the chips are down. So, but that's not really what the film's about. And, Cormac himself said it's about human goodness and I think that's very important. And I also, but at the same time, I love realism and things that strike a chord in, us as people and real characters. And I just think that, cinema, this thing about if a movie shows something that's grim, it's therefore grim and you've got to avoid it. I mean, what's happened? I look at film noirs. There's nothing more... depressing than just bad movies. There is no such thing as a depressing film that's you know, reasonable.
Let's just say something on this. Yeah. In terms of answer to your question, what's happened in the 1980s? In terms of the question of morality, there is a really interesting thing that the film raises, which is it's like that line from God Save the Queen, which I'm sure is a quote from somewhere else, when there's no future, there can be no sin. The interesting thing about it is it sets up a world in which everything's ending, therefore moral codes have just fallen out the window because there is no future, there is nothing to be moral for, and yet at the centre of it is in the relationship between the father and the son, their own very, very, which is that the father believes in the son and the son believes in the... And the son starts to worry that the father's belief that you have to shut everyone else out is actually the real beginning of the end.
That's right. I mean, God, thank God you're here, Mark. If only I could
and
be that articulate.
Rarely have I heard that phrase used.
I say that every Friday.
No, I mean, exactly. I mean, the thing is, it is a morality tale. It is about how we react to fear. You know, any of fear does shut out possibilities. It's a natural instinct. But, you know, I think we've been living through a decade of where we've just been very much in reaction to things. And it's that reactionary mode that kicks in that is also very destructive. It's aggressive. It's, you know, it's kind of animal-like. And it's, you know, it does shut out these possibilities that we have to hang on to and protect.
John, we appreciate you coming in. Thanks very much indeed for staying an extra few minutes and going a few extra miles down the road. And I hereby promise that I will complete your movie.
Thank you.
It wasn't my fault that I had to leave it, but I will make sure that I see the rather important final 25
I'll
minutes.
See it with you, because I'll happily see it a third time. Because right. Again, just to finish that point, because a movie is about a depressing subject, the movie itself doesn't have to be depressing. That is absolutely
crucial. I think we'll need to discuss this once you're gone, because you have to go, but... Yeah. John saying there's no such thing as a depressing film is a very interesting statement.
Other than Michael Bay.
We will...
I'm with you.
Exactly. So there is such a thing as a depressing film.
Yes. Wow.
John, thanks very much indeed. You have to go. You have another live interview to do, but I really appreciate you coming in. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
John Hilcutt, director of The Road.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.